Chaos at American airports as security lines stretch out for hours. Is this because Democrats won't fund ICE? Why isn't anyone asking the real question? Why do we need the TSA at all? Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I'm your host, Peter Suderman. And today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mangue Ward, Matt Welch, and Nick Gillespie. Happy Monday, everybody. Okay, so the Department of Homeland Security is shut down because of a government funding dispute about ICE, the Immigration Enforcement Agency. Democrats don't want to fund it after all the stuff that went on in Minnesota. At least they don't want to fund it until there are some reforms made. I mean, specifically just stuff like they don't want ICE agents running around in masks. But in the meantime, because the TSA is part of DHS, it's under DHS, airport security is incredibly chaotic and dysfunctional because the TSA agents aren't being paid. Catherine, to me, this is just a story about stupid American bureaucracy, about departments we don't need, agencies that never should have existed, right? Travel times are up for flyers because of a political dispute about ICE agents wearing masks.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you're opening remarks were like entirely alphabet soup is always a good sign that something has gone terribly wrong. Like the TSA and the DHS and the ICE and the whatever can't get their shit together. Great.
But DHS was going to help with the interagency.
I hate that.
That was the whole point sentence. Was to coordinate between other agencies that were doing a bad job.
Right. So this is like, how do you say that word? Matryoshka doll.
Matryoshka
doll. None of us know.
Nesting Russian dolls.
It's a nesting Russian doll of dysfunction. So first of all, we have just the basic, why can't we pass a budget bill? Why can't we get stuff open and funded right now? Then we have below it the why did we establish DHS and TSA in the first place? What were their goals and how are they achieving them? Probably not. And then below that, we have the abolish everything layer. It would be super cool if we had individual airports or airlines manage their own security privately. Shout out to Reason Foundation founder Bob Poole, who has been saying this and many other things for years.
Nick, it's sort of unclear exactly what ICE is going to be doing in these airports. They've got Tom Homan saying, well, it's just an expansion of what they've already been doing. We've had ICE in airports. It's only 13 or 14 airports, according to the reports that I saw this morning. But Trump is saying the ICE deployment will allow them to, quote, do security like no one has ever seen before, including, quote, the immediate arrest of all illegal immigrants who have come into our country. How is this even going to work, right? Are they just going to start pulling people out of security lines?
You think lines are long now? I mean, Tom Homan is the architect of the family separation policy, so I expect to see a lot of crying children, but the family bathrooms and airports will probably be wide open. So, head there. If there's a line, we don't need the TSA for transportation security. Things existed before the TSA. 9/11 did not happen because of a failure of it happened not because airports were not safe. It happened because of an intelligence failure, and it happened because cockpit doors weren't hardened against hostage taking. And things like that. So when you look at the actual government's own analysis of TSA, since it was created in late 2001, it's been operational for over 25 years, and about 24 years. They are lucky when TSA gets 50% of the objects that are not supposed to go through the TSA checkpoints. You could do better, with private companies. There's a bunch of contracted airports in America that tend to do better, and they are quicker. They do no worse, and they're quicker. Foreign countries, foreign airports do all sorts of things. So just getting right to the meat of it, TSA is part of the problem, and it is, like many government programs, it should not exist in the first place. It could be done much better by other people. The other thing,
about the privatization part a little bit more, because this is something that Reason has been at the forefront of for 40, 50 years, basically as long as we have existed. I mean, go back to the 1980s, and I don't want to say every issue, but it was common to find a privatization case study in an issue of Reason Magazine.
The original front of the book, which was called Trends, was actually short for Trends in Privatization.
Right. And so part of what we did was we showed people, we both provided plans and then also did a case study for where it had happened with these articles of how privatization can work and make government services better. So how would a privatized TSA work?
Well, it's again,
TSA, it's a privatized function of security at airports. I mean, we have.
And you tell airports you're responsible for your own security.
Yeah, and the way that we have 20, there's 20 airports right now, including San Francisco and Kansas City and Orlando, and obviously Roswell, New Mexico, that have a private TSA function-like functions. That's regulated. That's the TSA says, okay, you can do it, but you have to do it under these rules. Can you satisfy those rules? And they're like, yep. And they satisfy those rules. And those employees don't have anything to do with the government shutdown.
So you just sort of, you just contract it out. It's like trash collection.
Well, you set up standards, that need to be met, and then you contract it out. Yeah.
And I will say also, like, people who fly private and sometimes at like the very smaller airports, they are already experiencing like a totally different security system, right? And this is something that, I think when we argue for privatization or kind of decentralization, we'll often point to, well, here's a smaller scale experiment where this thing is already happening. And it is already happening. If you fly on your little private jet, you are not a part of the cattle call of the, 4-hour security lines that our colleague Billy Binion was in New Orleans this weekend. You are already exempted. And if we can trust people to fly in those contexts with a lower level of security and a different level of security that is managed by different entities, I don't know why we can't trust it for everyone.
I mean, if you ended up with a privatized security system, though, wouldn't you end up with even more kind of pay to move through the line faster? The stuff that everybody hates, right? Like, Catherine, I know you want to defend this. I'm asking Matt, actually, right? Like, this sort of, people find flying deeply unfair right now because you got to pay for every little thing because some people move through the line faster and they're going to say, like, I know this is going to be a response. We shouldn't privatize TSA just because it would increase that sense of unfairness by nickel and diming people for every little part of this, the process.
Is Billy Binion being delayed at an airport in New Orleans fair to anybody? The answer, my friends, is no. My wife is somewhere trying to get from Chicago to this area, and like it's just not going to happen. So there was like a deadly crash or a collision in LaGuardia today. It's awful. People make dumb fairness arguments all the time. Bernie Sanders has a career, and I regret to say, although he's kind of charming and funny. Like, let's think this through, people. Like, governance is politics. It's just politics. So, all the things that you hate about federal politics, national politics, if the government is in charge of it, it's going to come for you. Anything that the federal government is involved in is going to get there some sooner rather than later. So maybe what you want to do is to have less of the federal government doing those jobs. And do you think that if an airport was in charge of its own thing, that it would want to somehow make their own operations less safe? That just seems kind of implausible, especially if they're kind of on the hook for that safety. There's nothing fair. I mean, you want absolute fairness. Go to any socialist country and stand in a bread line. Do you think that there's going to be workarounds to that? There always are. Always are. So my guess is, responsive to your question, that in San Francisco Airport, for example, the lines just aren't that long to begin with. You don't have the Billy Binion nightmare happening. And so, yes, there might be a supercharged line for the people who drink 85 cups of coffee a day and can't stop talking in gibberish. But the system itself is going to work a lot better.
I also was in the Phoenix airport last night or yesterday, which is supposedly one of the airports where the ICE personnel or Department of the Homeland Security Investigation personnel have been deployed. I will say that I was in the Phoenix airport for a panicked 23 minutes as I ran for my connection. So I did not get a chance to do very much on the ground reporting.
That was your high intensity training for the week?
That was it. I don't do a lot of cardio, so it wasn't great for anyone. But the idea that somehow a few ICE agents lurking anywhere in that airport was going to make people's lives better is also like a deeply foolish notion. Like the ICE people are not stepping in and scanning people's bags. And I think that's important to be clear about. The ICE people are just lurking, being security and helping manage the lines. Why do the lines need managing? Oh, great question. Because everything was already screwed up by Congress.
You know, also to pull out a little bit for a bigger perspective, this also goes to the fact that the federal government can't pass budgets in a timely fashion. Republicans are saying this is Democrats holding up funding because the DHS funding wasn't done, and the Democrats are taking the bold stance of not wanting to fund a mass agency that shoots citizens in the face. You know, there's politics involved here, but it's pathetic that Donald Trump, who is able to make cabinet members wear ill-fitting shoes because he is such a bully and has a majority in both houses of Congress, can't get a freaking budget bill across the door in a timely fashion so that he's not stuck, you know, having to negotiate at the last minute. This is a federal government problem from top to bottom. The way around it is by privatizing, decentralizing, and outsourcing things to the free market or a freer market.
Yeah, on that point, Matt, you've got J.D. Vance out there tweeting that Chuck Schumer, Democratic Senate Majority Leader, is holding the TSA funding hostage, right? And they're like, where they were trying to play some DHS-sponsored messages, basically blaming the lines on Democrats in airports. I understand that at least some of the airports are refusing to do that. But then there's this report in Punch Bowl this morning. And for people who don't know what Punch Bowl is, it's a kind of a congressional tip sheet that is very focused on insider Republican reporting. And what it basically said is that Donald Trump doesn't want Republicans in Congress to pass a bill to fund everything except ICE, all of the other parts of DHS. Republicans in Congress came to him and they said, we have a deal ready if you'll go for this, because what we want to do is solve this TSA problem and get the rest of DHS funded. And Trump said, no, I want to make this an issue. I want to make people feel pain. And Trump has done this before, right? We saw this with the immigration bill, the compromise bill, which wasn't great in a lot of ways, but was at least a little bit of an improvement. It was Congress doing something. And Trump said, no, don't pass it. He tanked that bill because he wanted immigration to be a live issue going into the 2024 election. Matt, what do you think about this? Is this Democrats' fault? Is it Trump's fault? Is it dumb to even be debating which side is at fault here?
Let's not forget that immigration bill thing. Trump was not the president.
Yeah.
He was a private citizen running for president and still, you know, de facto control of the party, who's, you know, all of his relatives run it these days. But still, that just shows how the legislative branch Republicans are really some of the most embarrassing human beings in public life, and should be shunned out of polite society. They can eat brunch. It's fine. No problem. Just please don't be in charge of anything. It's pathetic. You have to like go up. Can you please support this thing before we think about maybe passing it? No, pass it. Give it to him. Then see what happens. That the Republican Party in Congress hasn't done anything like that for a long time. Yeah, he clearly wants this. He wants to make a big issue over the SAVE Act, which is to federalize the way that voter rolls are done in the states in terms of illegal immigrants, chasing down this son of Chimera. How do you pronounce that word?
Chimera.
Matryoshka.
Matryoshka of illegal immigrants voting in millions of numbers, which, remember, Donald Trump has alleged about 2016, not even 2020 or 2024. So he wants to make a big deal of the SAVE Act. And he's got toadies like Mike Lee out there trying to do that, thinking that it's going to be popular. I don't think it's going to be popular. I think that it's inherently unpopular to have a bad time at the airport. And there's a lot of other things going on that are anxiety inducing and Trump's poll numbers are in the crapper. It's on him. Do you want me to lay the exact level of blame on everybody? No, I don't. I'm not a scientist.
But you come across as so scientific and rational.
I know.
Yeah.
Senior fellow in political blame studies.
Yeah. You should pioneer political sabermetrics, Matt.
Nate Silver tried.
Yeah, that's true. Look where it got him.
We are going to try to talk about something else in the news right after this. Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners. Do you know a student looking for a serious intellectual experience that strengthens the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students ages 16 to 24 to the 2026 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago. It's from July 26th to August 2nd this summer. This year's theme is Reason and Love. It explores the ideas that shape character, choice, and human flourishing. Students engage directly with thinkers like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and Alexis de Tocqueville. They're in small, dynamic discussion groups. Every claim requires evidence and reasoning. They don't just sit through lectures. They practice thinking for themselves. Outside the seminar room, students explore Chicago's cultural landmarks, analyze art firsthand, experience live improv comedy, and build friendships rooted in shared intellectual ambition. Parents, if you want your student equipped to reason independently, to speak confidently, and contribute meaningfully to a free society, this program was built just for them. Registration is just $900, including room for the full week, and scholarships are available. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason. So last week, labor and civil rights leader Cesar Chavez was belatedly accused of sexual assault in a major investigative story in the New York Times. Chavez was the co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union, and last week was supposed to be the time when we had the celebrations, not we necessarily, but when people were celebrating him on Cesar Chavez Day. Those celebrations were largely canceled after the allegations came out. Allegations are obviously new, but Reason has been writing about Chavez and his union's abuses since the late 1970s. Nick, you also wrote about this last week. Yeah. You want to tell us about it?
Yeah, and I guess the only Cesar Chavez Day that's going forward is on Epstein's Island or something.
Too soon.
I hate it.
Well, in 1979, we had a cover story about how the United Farm Workers, the group that he co-founded, was bilking taxpayers basically to get money to do union organizing and to build a compound in a kind of remote part of California, where he had Chavez by that point had become friendly with the founder of Synanon, who was famous for kinds of various sorts of psychological torture of its members, which he had ported over into how he ran the UFW. And that story had real effects. I'm sure it'll be in the show notes I think it's the December 1979 story or something like that. But hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of taxpayer dollars went missing in order to build the UFW. In writing the story where I recounted some of the ongoing, kind of taxpayer financed abuses of the UFW, I also read in the old defunct Left Business Observer a scathing review of a kind of hagiography of Chavez that came out in 2008. And there, and this was from a very progressive writer talking about the UFW, said that the farm workers in California's lives were no better off because of the UFW. It had a membership in the early 70s of about 80,000. It is down to about 5,000 people now, where it's been for a very long time. And it was because Chavez should be remembered not as an effective organizer who called attention to the horrible plight of migrant workers, who in many ways were working under terrible conditions with very little rights and whatnot. But he is a classic case of somebody who became a monstrous the minute that he had a modicum of power. So that's the real legacy of Cesar Chavez, and it's a disturbing one. And then when you layer on the accounts of sexual assault, it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah, that piece you linked to and quoted from in your piece was pretty remarkable, because it was a socialist taking down another socialist for basically being an authoritarian grifter. But Chavez was, until last week, Matt, kind of a revered figure in California politics. Does that tell us anything about the role that unions play in shaping and maybe in deforming California policy and governance?
I think he was a revered figure kind of by default. I'm 57 years old, and I doubt there's almost anyone younger than me. And Gustavo Arellano wrote a piece about this in the LA Times. Like, if you think of the names Cesar Chavez, you think of Julio Cesar Chavez, who was a boxer of some renown back in the day. So he was a figure that was renowned partly because he rose to prominence precisely when Mexican Americans, in particular Latinos, started joining the civil rights movement. Late 60s, early 70s, there was a big, big sort of wave of Chicano activism and participation in just sort of the great struggles, social struggles. And so that that moment needed a kind of face, a leader who was associated with it. And he was doing it while expanding labor into a place that labor rights, union organization rights, into a sector that hadn't seen it before. So all of those kind of combined. And he's a charismatic figure. And so, okay, you know, let's make him the kind of saint of all of this. I don't know if everybody woke up in the morning in California over the last 25 years and said, you know, damn, Cesar Chavez is great. But I do know that we call it Cesar Chavez Boulevard once Sunset Boulevard goes into more towards East LA. And there's going to be a lot of renaming for that. I think the question of the union sort of taking over California and blue state is overlapping, not the same thing, but like also in some ways much more systematically insidious. And I'm sure we'll talk about that later on in the show, but just the public sector union capture of California and New York and Chicago. And
it's not just public sector unions. I actually want to expand this out to public and private. You know, public sector unions for sure are particularly insidious in a specific way. Influence of the teachers unions has just been atrocious over the past couple of years. I think people have really seen that they are not good actors, not good for society, not good for students. But it's more than just the public sector unions, I think, in some ways, Catherine, right? The billionaire tax proposal in California is sponsored by some private sector labor unions. When Joe Biden was president, one of the things he proposed that people forget is basically a $400 billion slush fund for the SEIU that was initially proposed to be in the infrastructure bill. And so I guess I just want to ask you to pull back here and talk about the role that unions, public and private, are playing in Democratic politics right now, because I just don't see a case. I see unions blocking automation at ports, right? That's the dock workers unions. I see them. They're fighting losing battles in Hollywood. The big strike that the Writers Guild went on, the Actors Guild went on, maybe it was good for some of the top writers, but it was probably bad for the people who were coming up, and it's bad for the industry as a whole. I see teachers and police unions. The main thing that they seem to do is aggressively protect their worst members. There's this crazy story out of Seattle right now where the rideshare drivers union sponsored a bill that drove up costs, caused fewer rides to be done. And now they're like, we got to limit the number of drivers we have. Right. And, then there's just this whole thing in California, especially, but all over, where unions are using all of these kind of environmental legal process reviews to hold up development and make it basically impossible to build anything. What is the case that unions are good for ordinary Americans who are not part of unions right now?
Oh, baby, I'm not going to be making that case. But yeah, I will say that, unions get special treatment under the law, and they should not. No one should get special treatment under the law. No institution should get special treatment, et cetera, et cetera. And the reason that so many of these unions remain powerful, even when they are clearly not serving either their members or the general public, is because of the kind of mostly invisible mechanisms of the National Labor Relations Board and other kind of carve outs that unions get. To me, the good news in what Nick just described was the fall from 80,000 to 5,000. Like, if market mechanisms are allowed to operate on unions, it's fine. People can have unions as long as a union is no different than any other kind of club or association, which is to say, people should not be forced to pay into dues, should not be forced to pay dues to be a member of the union in any way, shape, or form. Right to work laws, I think, are a great thing and should exist everywhere. And which would mean that people do not there's no such thing as a closed shop. I was a member of the union when I worked at the New York Times because I had to be, and that sucked and I hated it.
Could have quit your job on principle.
I could have quit my job. I will also say, you know, when there is kind of government money or special treatment to be had, you will always find the kind of corruption. And frankly, like, the Me Too movement suggests that maybe you will also always find the kind of sexual misbehavior, or almost always, that that we see in this case. He had the special protections that unions get, and then he also had kind of entanglement. Chavez had entanglement with the state in ways that made it all worse. You know, Reason has been skeptical of a lot of Me Too claims, and so I do want to put an asterisk here. Like, it's hard for me to give Cesar Chavez, you know, the benefit of the doubt, because he sucked. But we always should. Having read the investigation, I think it's pretty compelling. I ate some grapes and some iceberg lettuce just like to stick it to the man. So
it's a lot more compelling than a whole hell of a lot of Me Too stories were circa 2020.
Absolutely. But I will cop to the fact that I might have bias, right? Like, I will cop to the fact that reading this, I'm like, that sounds right. He did suck. And that happened a lot of other ways.
This is 95-year-old or 96-year-old co-founder of the UFW who says that she had two children fathered by him, one the result of a sexual assault, is on the record like shaming women in the UFW and in the union movement decades ago for all kinds of things. It's a very complicated story, the Me Too and the sexual assault claims. I think one of the things that is worth kind of always thinking about this is how people like Chavez wormed his way into political power. He nominated Jerry Brown to be president at the 1976 Democratic National Convention and things like that. And I, you know, Peter, your point is taken that groups like the SEIU, which have a fair amount of power now, I think that power is still dwarfed by public sector unions that really are running the show in the Democratic Party for sure.
To be clear, I think public sector unions are worse.
I agree, just the much bigger.
SEIU is not fully a private sector union. It overlaps, and it has been for 30 years now making a lot of inroads on making really, really bad broad-based public policy as well. So they've got their fingers in some pies.
Well, that's partly because, and there's a great piece from Reason by Mike McMenamin from 20 years ago, maybe more, about how the SEIU, its business model is to move into low-wage, high-turnover fields and unionize. And that way, the people who are working the jobs that the SEIU tends to represent, you know, they just see it as a tax on having a job because they're not going to be doing that work in a couple of years anyway. And to Matt's point, you know, the way that they're in more and more Medicare and Medicaid funded healthcare facilities, it becomes this weird hybrid of public and private type stuff. But my main point is, you know, it comes back to public sector unions for sure, private sector unions and politicians. I mean, this is California, that the politicians don't have to be captive to, you know, the unions. And like at some point, just as Catherine should have, as a point of pride, not worked at the New York Times, if she had to join the union, she should have been, you know, a little bit more, you know, Henry David Thoreau, there's a three-part miniseries about a documentary series by Ken Burns coming out about him in a couple months. That'll be interesting. But, you know, politicians need to stand up. I mean, they need to stand up for their constituents, to the special interests, to the president. I mean, you know, we should, I sometimes get upset at a kind of libertarian nihilism where we just assume that politicians, of course, they're pieces of shit and we can't expect anything. And we should demand more from them.
Nick, I will make you a deal. I will be Henry David Thoreau if I, too, get to have meals made for me and my laundry done by my mom.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
No, we have an example of a politician, maybe not standing up to unions in a sort of general kind of macro sense, but standing up to one bad union idea in California, which is Gavin Newsom opposes the billionaire tax. Right, Matt?
Yeah.
Like, and this is as he is preparing for a run for president. And it's not official, but he's clearly wanting to reposition himself.
I'm glad I'm not going to yet give him a cookie for opposing a retroactive income tax. A retroactive tax. Yeah. You oppose that because that is some of the stupidest ideas anyone has ever heard in all of our lifetimes. And it's also on unrealized capital gains. There isn't any tax that has been this stupid in America, perhaps in my entire lifetime. That's how stupid this tax is. So yes, Gavin Newsom, high five, man.
I also appreciate that California is already incurring the costs of even talking about this.
Of course.
Like, it's excellent, excellent discipline that people are like, listen, maybe Newsom's opposed to it. Maybe it's not. But no one, there's a lot of people who are not willing to take that chance to find out. And they are the billionaires that left California are the real Thoreaus in our modern day, don't you think?
Yeah,
Nick?
That's right. They're going to Galt's Gulch in Westchester County, New York.
They're going to Florida. Steven Spielberg moved to New York. No, there's an interesting analysis going around showing that 12 billionaires have either left recently or are likely to leave. Not all of them are saying that they're going to leave because of this. They're not attributing it specifically to the billionaire tax. But in many cases, the timing really does seem to line up. And when these billionaires leave, they are going to take $1 trillion in wealth with them. And they're going to make the budget problems in California worse. And this is happening all over, right? This isn't the only stupid tax proposal or tax that has passed in a big blue state recently. Massachusetts, millionaire surtax, new report shows, just lost the state $4.2 billion in income. In Washington state, they passed a millionaire tax, and Starbucks founder Howard Schultz moved to Florida like the next day. It might not be the next day, but like very soon after. You've got this this mansion tax thing that Mamdani is proposing on homes that are worth $750,000, which is definitely not a mansion in New York City. And then there's this interesting IRS data. I don't know if you guys saw this. That just came out on the tax effects of blue state outmigration. So this is from 2023. It's a couple of years old because it takes a little while to gather this data. But in 2023, red states gained $37.2 billion in income and 492,000 tax filers, and blue states lost $40 billion and filers, human beings, as a result of this.
I do not identify as a tax filer, and I do not want you to refer to people as tax filers.
You are one for IRS purposes, Catherine.
My pronouns, please.
So, but like, take this back to the Gavin Newsom thing. He's actually coming out and saying, this is stupid. Let's not do this. Maybe we need to tax rich people more, but not this way. Is there some hope here that Democrats who want to win elections like Gavin Newsom are learning?
Here's the hope. I got an email from my city councilwoman who has an office 100 feet from where I'm sitting here, right? Not close to my furnace, as Nick had pointed out, but just down around the corner. I got an email from her last night here in Brooklyn. The subject line, tax the rich, fund our city. Then she goes on. The question is not whether we can afford to invest in our communities. It's whether we're willing to ask the wealthiest New Yorkers to pay their fair share. I think that there is no reason for hope, Peter Suderman. Show me an important Democrat on the nationwide stage, or even just on a governor somewhere, who is principally opposed to increasing taxes because the government is spending too much, which was a pretty mainstream Democratic idea as recently as the 1990s in certain places, including in the White House to some degree. Now that's pretty much extinct. The bluer city or state that you go, the more that people are doing this. By the way, mansion tax, the median house price in my zip code is $2.5 million, I learned this morning. So, yeah.
So everybody's living in a triple mansion?
This thing... This thing ain't a mansion. Actually, you got the close shot, not the wide shot. But there's no reason to hope that Democrats are getting smarter about this in places that they control.
All right, no reason to hope. That's a good note to break on. We're going to come back with a listener question about Cuba after this. It's tax season again, and charitable donors all over are digging through emails, receipts, and bank statements, and they're trying to reconstruct a year's worth of charitable giving. The good news is there is a better way. Donors Trust is the donor-advised fund provider for libertarians. Our friends at Donors Trust can help you simplify your giving, maximize your tax advantages, and support the causes you believe in, all from one account. You can contribute cash, stock, or other assets, and you'll receive a single receipt for your tax deduction each year. You can recommend grants to your favorite organizations on your own schedule. So no more December 31st rush. No more tax season scramble. Plus, the experts at Donors Trust can advise you on the most effective giving strategies. Their team shares your limited government views and will ensure that your giving remains faithful to your convictions. To learn more, download 6 key reasons to use a donor-advised fund. Just go to donorstrust.org/reason. That's donorstrust.org/reason. This will make your next tax season so much less painful. All right, a reminder, we love to answer your questions. You can send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long questions to podcasts@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. Please include the words listener question in your subject line, like Dan, who wrote this week's question. Dan asks, as the child of a Cuban immigrant and a first-generation Cuban American, a Cuba free from communism is genuinely exciting. But seeing what happened in Venezuela doesn't give me much hope. Still, Rubio's personal connection to Cuba and the larger Cuban-American community just 90 miles from the island make me think a real transition plan could actually be part of any U.S. action there. What would a libertarian-approved constitutional approach to U.S. action in Cuba actually look like, Catherine?
I mean, we could start by just unilaterally opening up as much as we can to the island. I think that's like an underappreciated piece of this. Policy has gone back and forth between different administrations about how free Americans are to travel to and from Cuba, to trade with Cubans, to smuggle things into Cuba, to do electronic business there, to put Starlinks there. To me, there is just this first step, which is, you know, as Dan, our letter writer, says, there are lots of people who would put their own sweat, blood, and tears into a free Cuba even before we get to anything, you know, more elaborate in terms of federal policy, just doing everything that we can to open up the opportunities of Americans to interact with Cubans from our side, I think could be an underappreciated element of success.
Let me buy Cuban rum. I like it. Nick, what about you?
I agree with Catherine, and you know, the idea of just letting Americans trade more freely. Matt and I in 2016 went to Havana and the surrounding towns as part of a Reason trip. One of our party was not able to go, and it turned out the problem wasn't with the Cuban government; it was actually with the American government. You know, Jeff Flake, who was kind of the person who set up that trip for us, he was right. Every year that he was in Congress and the Senate, he authored a bill to end the embargo with Cuba. That would be the beginning, but it's not. Unfortunately for Dan, a lot of the sticking is going to come from Cuban Americans, as well as people who have claims, some legit, some that will just have to be forgiven, about expropriated land and businesses and stuff like that. So it you know, looking at it from an American point of view, you know, just let Americans trade and, you know, visit wherever they want, unless we are actively at war with a country. That would be the first best stop. The other thing, and this would be a little bit of a high flyer, the Trump administration should offer indemnity to the Cuban regime and give them, up to a certain level. I don't know, you know, a GS, you know, a Castro level 5 or something. Say, we'll transport you to whatever country will accept you. Get the regime out without going in militarily or anything like that. That would be maybe a novel way to actually get a bad leader out. We did something vaguely similar with that in Haiti in the 90s under Bill Clinton.
I mean, honestly, operating a country club for retired dictators would be a service to the world. And I have thought about that a lot. Like, if the U.S. had some way to do this that was totally consensual and peaceable, like, I don't know, there's got to be something out in West Texas that we could outfit real nice. Turn Gitmo into like a nice place to be.
Just upgrade the gym.
Yeah.
I think we can just call it Mar-a-Lago.
Oh.
No,
interesting.
We can't. I hear a lot from Cubans and Cuban Americans right now who are basically saying, look, it can't get worse. And it really than it is right now. And the situation is incredibly desperate. And I recommend people watch all of the kind of armchair Marxists in America on their little freedom tours right now, who are staying in some of the only places that you can stay where there's electricity. And talking about their solidarity with the people in Cuba who don't have electricity. I understand and feel deeply that desperation and the feeling like, well, Marco Rubio is you know, his parents are Cuban, and he cares a lot about this issue, probably more than he does about Venezuela. And Venezuela is sort of a way to get to Cuba from his point of view. So let's just roll the dice. I can sympathize with that. But the roll the dice for me, in order to be constitutional, if there's any military involved, that has to be debated and voted on in Congress. And if there's not military involved, I'm worried about the fact that Rubio is negotiating reportedly with Raulito Castro, the ratbag 41-year-old grandson of Raul, who still disgraces us with his presence in the world. I don't want another Delcy Rodriguez situation for Cuba. That's not a great solution. I think right now the U.S. has a ton of leverage, and there's a lot of fear after Venezuela, and it'd be great if they used that to empty political prisoners and to encourage president to leave and to encourage freedom for a lot more people and activities, and not have the government have a stranglehold on absolutely everything that comes to the island as a preliminary step. But that's a 67-year-old revolution by now. It's ingrained deeper in that society than the Iranian revolution is in that society. And it's very, very difficult to just wave a magic wand and have that go away.
Just let me buy the Cuban rum. Okay, let's move on to our final topic. Justice for Afro Man. Everybody here know who Afro Man is? Do people know the song Because I Got High?
A classic.
Right? Yeah. Right. So the cops raided his house a couple of years ago on a completely bogus tip that he was like holding a hostage or something. They did that he'd kidnapped somebody. They did $20,000 worth of damage. They ate his lemon pound cake. It was all recorded on security footage, and then they charged him with nothing because the whole thing was just bogus. So Afro Man responded in the way that Afro Man responds to things, with funny rap songs. He made funny rap songs about the cops who kicked down his door and ate his cake, and the cops sued him. And last week, justice was served as a jury said, you know what? You're allowed to do that. It's a great story for free speech. Nick, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm all in favor of it. And you would think people would learn that when you file defamation cases, the odds of the Streisand effect taking place are just gigantic. You know, Henry Ford was unmasked as an idiot who was completely ignorant of American history. His line where he said history is bunk came from a defamation lawsuit that he filed that showed in testimony he did not know who Patrick Henry was. This was a guy who claimed to be a super patriot, and ended up publishing the Protocols of the Elder of Zion, and he did not know anything about American history. Just don't file defamation lawsuits when you don't have to. To me, what's most interesting and exciting about the reaction to Afro Man is that everybody seems to be united behind the idea that, yes, you have the right to mock people in power when they do stuff to you. And that's almost universal. The flip side of this is that if you look at Gallup and other kind of data about what parts of American life, what institutions still have people have high regard for, inevitably it's the police and law enforcement. So, you know, people should zero in on the Ohio cops, the police who filed this lawsuit, and they should really give them a stern talking to, because they're helping to drive down one of the last institutions that, for whatever reason, is held in high regard by American people.
Can I share a truly delightful exchange from CJ Cirumella's coverage of this important case?
Yeah, I think I know where you're going, and I was going to ask you about it.
One of the officers testified that the music video where Afro Man says he had sex with the officer's wife painted him in a false light and caused him, quote, tremendous pain. And the Afro Man's lawyer said, but we all know that's not true, right? And the officer said, I don't know. And then there was a long pause. And then the lawyer says, you don't know if your wife is cheating on you or not?
Yeah. And that's how we win. That's how Afro Man won.
Those exchanges, there was crying, you know, there was crying at this trial. This is right. Like, I think CJ used the phrase Drake-like self-ownage. And I think that is also a good characterization. We might need to leave Streisand effect behind and move to a slightly more updated reference. But couldn't have happened, again, to nicer guys that they are now the subject of public mockery. And I will say, sorry, reason absolutely must and shall forever stand for funny musical parody videos that make fun of the cops, because that's like maybe a solid 20% of our business. So we're gonna need to fight for that.
I got freedom of speech after they run around my house with the guns and kick down my door. I got the right to kick a can in my backyard, use my freedom of speech, and turn my bad times into a good time. Yes, I do. That's what Afroman said after he won. Matt, I assume you're just jealous of his amazing, amazing American flag suit.
It's the best suit. And it's important to accessorize with the sunglasses also during the flag. Mm-hmm. Thing. There's a great interview with him on Saturday on Fox News. Incredibly, it's the hero that we didn't know we need kind of interview. And he asked him at the end. So, you know, what's your message for the 250th anniversary of America? And he's like, you know, free speech and all that good stuff. Like, yes,
yes,
that's actually yes. The correct answer to all
100%.
That, wearing your American flag suit. If you read a bunch of history, as I've been doing the last year and a half about American history, one thing that really sticks out is how much it was in the American character before we detached from the Redcoats to support what in other places would be a prosecutable conduct in defaming and even doing seditious libel. Which would be prosecutable in England, but not in America. We fought and won those cases in colonial court over and over again, because we just have this American sense that we, yes, are going to mock the people in power who are doing us wrong. It's something uniquely American about that. And that gives me a little bit of hope right now that the reaction to him is like 100 exactly percent positive, except for those four cops.
All right. I think since you talked about people in power, I want to go to Catherine and ask, what do you have for us for your cultural consumption this week? You were very offline, weren't you?
I was very offline this week, and also mostly culturally consumed like beach read type stuff. But I did... there's a forthcoming mini review in the next issue of the magazine. And so I listened for it to several episodes of the Boring History for Sleep podcast. And I did that not because I have trouble sleeping. I actually sleep fine, but because I just love that this exists, right? I think particularly among podcast listeners generally, of whom there are many, many of you here, people be using podcasts to go to sleep. I know of at least one person who favors Russ Roberts's podcast for that purpose, but also a recent staffer who shall be unnamed who routinely falls asleep to the Hardcore History podcast, which is like not a good choice, because there's like sometimes you wake up at 2 a.m. and it's like the streets ran red with blood, which we don't need, right? You don't need that in your subconscious. So this podcast is specifically designed to serve the niche that people were DIYing before now. It's a soothing British voice that reads overly detailed, kind of generic history facts for as many as 4 hours at a time. And
it's like ASMR Wikipedia.
It's ASMR Wikipedia. Is it written by AI? Probably. Like a lot of it has AI-ish hallmarks. Is it read by AI? Maybe. Probably. The whole thing about it, right, is like it is serving its purpose. And we just need to understand that its purpose is boring. I hope no one's using this podcast for that purpose already. I think we're too chaotic. But if you are looking for a soporific that is not medical, otherwise going to damage your brain chemistry, I suggest the Boring History for Sleep podcast. Weirdly delightful and just such a wonderful, like, markets and everything moment.
I know someone who listens to political podcasts to take naps in particular, also to sleep sometimes at night. And then this person wakes up and is like, in my dream, John Podoritz was arguing about horrible. The war in Iran. Nope. In my dream. Jonah Goldberg was talking about his dogs. And this is, you know, somebody's in journalism friendly with all of these people, right? But it's just like the podcast characters start literally inhabiting your dreams.
Yeah. So this avoids that problem. I will say, when I was in high school, on the day that Newsweek magazine arrived every week, I used to come home from school and pick up Newsweek magazine and then fall asleep on the couch for an hour. So I have a long history of this.
You know what I watch, listen to fall asleep, right?
Probably like Blade Runner.
Not Blade Runner. But historic, like for a long time it was Taxi Driver, and then I switched to Seven.
That's fucked up.
Yeah, great movie. Matt Welch.
I listen to Jack Henneman's History of the Americans podcast to fall asleep because it's only 30 minutes long. And so you just, nice voice. And after 6 minutes, donk. And it takes you like an entire week to get through one episode that way. Anyway, I went unsurprisingly to the CIA this weekend.
Yeah.
With my daughter, by which I mean the Culinary Institute of America, over up in upstate New York, Poughkeepsie Hyde Park area. That is the seat, to my surprise, of the Northern Dutchess County Symphony Orchestra, which performed a thing called Americana 250, which was just like you can imagine that it's going to be. It's going to be like a guy.
Was there Afro Man there?
In spirit. He might have even been referenced, might not have been. Maybe just it was me mumbling happily under my breath. They played patriotic songs while doing a slideshow presentation of important places and events in the Hudson Valley during the Revolutionary War, which was a very key theater of that war. They had guys in like period costume and wigs and tricorn hats. Reading dramatic stories about George Washington's spectacles and the history of the Yankee Doodle song, which is truly fascinating. They did some Aaron Copland. And at the end, he told this incredible story about a 16-year-old girl I'd never heard of called Sybil Luddington, who Nick probably knows because he just knows too many things. But she was a 16-year-old girl who has been, let's say, known as the teenage girl Paul Revere for doing a dashing 40-mile ride on her horse to warn about the Redcoats sacking Danbury, Connecticut in 1777. And all this, it was a really gripping, fascinating story. And my 11-year-old daughter's like, you know, heck yeah. And they played some nice songs. And then I went and Wikipedia'd it. Sybil Luddington existed, but there's no evidence that this happened. The first mention of it in her family 100 years later, probably in the wake of the Longfellow poem, The Ride of Paul Revere, saying, yeah, no, we had one of that. She did that thing too. It's a super great story. And I love it. And she still was like on bicentennial stamps in 1975. There's a statue of her up by in the town of Carmel, but I don't think that she actually did the thing. But it was a really wonderful event. And I encourage people, since you can't go and see this exact thing that I saw, but I guarantee you, that somewhere near where everyone is listening to this, there's going to be some orchestra playing some America 250 related content, and you're going to love it because it's super awesome. The end.
Did they do a lot of John Philip Sousa? Because that would turn a lot of people against America.
I don't think that they did do the Copeland's Appalachian dance
spring.
Spring.
Very good.
I played the sousaphone for 7 years. What do you have against John Philip Sousa?
Just his music.
I mean, to be fair, there's more to the man, I'm sure.
Dump. Okay, I'm going to talk now about the thing that I saw, which is Project Hail Mary. Huge movie. Everybody saw this.
Swear to God.
You've read the book.
I know.
You've interviewed Andy Weir.
If you in any way diminish my enjoyment of this film in any way, shape, or form, I will shiv you.
I could not possibly diminish your enjoyment of this film because it is preposterously charming. It's so charming that they need to measure it somehow. Like, it's dangerous levels of charming. Like, you have to be worried about it. It's like some sort of ultra potent charm chemical where you're just like, this seems worrying to me how charmed I am by this. In particular, the fact that it is charming because of a puppet. And you've read the book, so you can guess what the puppet is. It's the little alien rock guy who's kind of like a spider and kind of like a dog and kind of like R2-D2 and kind of like your best buddy. And it's like, it's a movie about male loneliness and about how Ryan Gosling is kind of smart but like sad and lonely and doesn't have any friends. So he goes out into deep space and makes buddies with a rock puppet. And it's just so enjoyable. It is a perfect crowd-pleasing movie. And it is also a movie that I think has a a libertarian soul and ethos. And Andy Weir, we've interviewed him several times. Catherine, you've interviewed him a couple of times. Zach Weissmuller has interviewed him. So he's kind of, you know, somebody who is engaged with reason, I think, in interesting ways. He said he is a small L libertarian, or that he has small L libertarian tendencies. Well, this is not a political movie, and it doesn't feel like a lecture in any way. This is a movie about how when big problems arrive, you can just solve them. And maybe it'll be hard, right? And you might not even want to do it. You might even feel like you're the right guy, but you can solve them through engineering and through ingenuity rather than trying to reorganize society. Just an absolute blast. Strongly recommend it.
I saw it too, and would just quickly, super enjoyable. I recommend going and looking at it, but a couple shades less than perfect. It went for some like cheap laughs, cheap music. And such, even though the music overall was fantastic. That's it.
I like a cheap laugh. Nick?
I read The Sovereign Child as the father of a three-month-old. This is a book by Aaron Stupple, and the subtitle is How a Forgotten Philosophy Can Liberate Kids and Their Parents. And it is inspired by a movement in England that was big in England in the 90s called Taking Children Seriously, which was founded by Sarah Fitzclerridge and David Deutsch, who is a Oxford physicist of incredible world renown. Aaron Stupple sent me a copy of it, and he immediately gained my trust because he is a doctor who does not put MD or doctor on the title page. So this is an amazing amount of restraint.
Unlike Dr. Jill Biden.
The Taking Children Seriously movement comes out of a tradition of thinking, an old tradition of thinking of kids as kind of rational and little adults. You know, it's not marred by the whole kind of 20th century move towards ideas about youth development and adolescence and things like that. And it's fascinating. It is about how do you engage your kids in a way where you're not bossing them around all the time. It is great reading for the father of a three-month-old because the kid really can't talk back very much. And I'm going to be, I find it very refreshing. It overlaps with parts of free-range parenting and a couple of other libertarian-oriented ideas like unschooling and things like that. And the acid test, of course, will come, you know, when the kid turns 3 years old or 13 years old rather than 3 months old. But I highly recommend The Sovereign Child, How a Forgotten Philosophy Can Liberate Kids and Their Parents from Aaron Stupple.
This is a... Do you feel like this is a parenting theory that is in need of revival? That like, I mean, I guess I didn't hear about that. You said this is sort of in the 1990s.
In England. So it's like you had to be, you know, listening to Oasis, I guess, you know, at the same time. You had to be into Brit pop and Brit parenting.
Like what happened to it that we ended up going from that to gentle parenting or wherever it is we're in?
Yeah, and gentle parenting, I think, is already on the way out. I think what particularly happened over, and I've written a lot over the years about parenting kind of attitudes and theories over the past 100 years or so. We constantly are going back and forth between what historian Ann Hulbert calls hard and soft parenting kind of motifs. This is interesting because taking children seriously is somewhere in between. You don't shield the kids from punishments if they fail to live up to their end of their responsibilities, but you're also giving them a lot of space to kind of find themselves. But I think the extreme kind of overscheduling of children and the rise of helicopter parenting, even or maybe especially among people who swore that they would never do that with their kids, this is the kind of corrective to a lot of that sort of stuff. It also has certain analogs with Brian Kaplan's, you know, what I forget the exact...
Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids.
Thank you. Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, which is kind of like if you're not enjoying something and your kids are not enjoying something, don't create a mutual assured destruction pact where you're going to force the kid to go to tap dancing lessons every day that you have to drive and pick them up from and nobody is gaining from it. So I think that's one of the reasons why we would benefit from having more models of parenting.
Sounds very libertarian. It's almost like there's something to this worldview.
Perhaps.
You could like learn from it. All right, let's gentle parent this podcast to its end. Thanks for listening, folks. This is our show. If you want to donate to us, you can do so at reason.com/donate. You can support this podcast, the Reason Foundation, everything we do here. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you all for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return.